though, this your boy DOC. I have a very special guest on the line. If you would like to introduce yourself and where you're from.
How y'all doing? My name is Dexter Hudson. They call me Salsa, Sauce Money. I'm from Detroit, Southwest Detroit, Ecorse River Rouge area, the Downriver area. I'm originally out of Ecorse.
Word. Well, first off, before we start, I want to go ahead and say I greatly appreciate the time, you know, in the interview. And, you know, I know we got a lot to talk about. I definitely want to make, you know, talk about the reason why we're doing this interview, because it's based around, you know, the Black Mafia family blueprint to conspiracy. Can you let people know, like, what exactly that is?
Okay, the Blueprint to Conspiracy. It's a book that's it's an ebook that's basically we're gonna explain to you roughly who we are, where we came up from, where it all started, and along the way we're gonna be giving you different time frames and documents on the rise and fall, you know, of the family.
Now, let me ask you, because, you know, throughout this time, since the mid-2000s up until now, there have been, you know, a lot of DVDs and everything. Can you explain to the people what, like, differentiates this particular project from everything else that's out?
Well, if you notice, a lot of the DVDs that's out, like on YouTube and different things like that, the major ones, you know, like Marshall Loop, you have... Like especially Marshall Loop, you have like a lot of the federal cooperation, the governmental cooperation. So the story that they're telling is the story that they tried to put out and be sure that they kill any real stories to come out or dilute any story or anybody else's story that may come out. And ever since then, everything else had been based on or around that particular story. What's different with our story is with the story that I'm telling you on the story that I'm not going to take that back. It's not my story, but the documents that's going to come out and the things that I'm going to be saying are documented, but the people don't have access to. So what's going to make ours different is it's not going to be about where the smoke and mirrors, where they wanted you to be, they wanted you to believe, but it's going to be actually where it all started from, where the betrayal started and how long it started and who started the betrayal for real.
BMF started right here, Rushtown Management. That's what we was before BMF came along and all that. This was it right here. This is where we came at. You welcome to the hood. You have arrived.
I mean, everybody around here knows. See, the good thing about this is we can pull up and the story and the city can give you a million stories. Everybody's got a story about us. Everybody can tell you something. Somehow, some way, we touched everybody in this neighborhood. Everybody knows us.
Okay. Now, going back, let's go back a little bit to start from the beginning. You know, how would you explain your life, like growing up in your particular area of Detroit and Ecorse as a child, you know, just growing up prior to meeting Big Meech and Southwest T? Like, how would you explain your life and the environment at that time growing up in Detroit?
Well, I grew up in a great home. My father provided for it. My mother was a house mom. I had a lot of uncles that were in the street at the time. You know, the crimes wasn't really drugs like that per se. They were like, you know, like taking tractors and, you know, different things like that. It was pimping, stuff like that. I mean, I grew up around it. I seen all that, but, you know, I wasn't really interested into none of that. I grew up in the projects on 8th Street. In Ecorse, so you know it was a different time. The times were different. People wasn't getting shot and stuff like that. The worst you can get over there is like cut or stabbed with a knife. So times were different then. So I grew up around real old gangsters where like my grandfather was part of the Purple Gang with Al Capone and them. They used to bootleg whiskey from over in Canada back over here back into Detroit and then ship it to Chicago. So, you know, I was around the riots and stuff like that back in 69, 70, 68 when the riots started. I was a young boy, but I remember a lot of things going on, a lot of fires and a lot of stuff like that. You know, so, you know, I came up in the times were different, you know, but I seen a lot, especially me living over in the projects, coming up in the projects at the time.
Right. Now, speaking on the actual riots and everything, you know, you say you remember you were young during that time. can you, how did the city, how would you feel like the city before the riots and after the riots, how you feel like the city may have changed from your perspective being alive during that time? Was it like segregation?
Yeah, segregation. It's not segregated like it used to be. It was areas where you couldn't even come across the tracks. You know, you couldn't come in certain areas. You know, whites couldn't come here. And, you know, I'm saying blacks, they basically weren't where we wanted to. But it was always some animosity, you know. So, you know, everybody had their side, even though like the town I was from, Ecorse, and even in River Rouge, they had, Southwest Detroit was predominantly black. You know, it was all black. But we had sections in the town that I grew up in that only the white folks stayed on that side, and we stayed over here. So you knew you wouldn't cross. There was an imaginary line that you wouldn't cross.
Okay. Now, at some point in time, did you end up going off to college and school?
Yes, I went off to college in 84. I went down to Lane College in Jackson, Tennessee. I went down there, and then I went over to Tennessee State. Yeah, I played Omega Psi Phi down there.
Okay. So, yeah. And was this around the same time that you ended up meeting Big T and Meech? How did that happen? Did you come home on like a school break, or were you home, back home permanently? Can you describe, like, and, you know, describe to the people painting the picture, like how you end up meeting Big T and Meech?
Well, I came home in 85, I come home for the summer. I was coming home to take me a summer job, and I was going to go right on back. And my mother told me that my sister had a boyfriend, somebody that she was seeing that, you know, that she liked, and she really liked him. And I was like, my sister's a bit of a tomboy, so I'm like, she likes somebody? You know, I'm like, well, this guy must be pretty special, so I couldn't wait to meet him. So when I got home, I didn't meet Demetrius at that time. What I used to do was go up there to the arcade around the corner and just play video games and shoot pool. And, you know, it was like night.
Yeah, man, this is the car wash we used to get down at right here. We used to come back here, make sales, man, barbecue right here across the back. Like I said, he got it on. We know he got it on, and he didn't have no problem with it. We just kept the peace up here. We made sure that there was gonna be no bullshit, no shootings, or nothing like that up here. But we used to go right over in this corner.
You know, the hustle was, you know, crack was in, but, you know, I wasn't to no drugs. I was in the criminal psychology at the time. I was studying criminal psychology in school. I was in my second year in Tennessee, and I was just, you know, just home for the summer, thinking about where I'm going to be doing my undergraduate studies at. At the time, there was a place called down off of Otter Drive. It was the Veterans Administration Hospital. So that's where I was going to be doing my undergrad studies. That's where I was starting my undergrad study. But I used to go up to the store, and a lot of my buddies was out there, and they was always asking me about Demetrius. And I was like, man, why y'all keep asking me about that? And they was like, man, tell them we trying to get straight. And I was like, man, I don't know what, you know, I didn't know what the hell they was talking about. You know, I didn't know what they were talking about until I was getting straight. So I asked them, they finally told me. And when I finally met Demetrius, I was like, yo, man, I already know what you're doing. You know what I'm saying? I don't appreciate you around here with that. I ain't with it. You know, and don't have it around the house. So that's how I first met Demetrius. That was the first meeting with us. That's how we met.
Well, and, you know, with that, what you're saying, that, like, what was his reaction? Did he, you know, as being your sister's older brother, or whatever the case may be, how did he, you know, accept your terms, or how, you know, what you said to him about not having it around the house? Was he cool with it, or did, you know, how did that play out?
Oh, yeah, well, you know, me's a smooth guy, you know, so he was like, oh, man, you ain't got to worry about that. You know, I wouldn't bring none of that around here. I ain't going to put nothing, you know, in your people in them house, man. I got a lot of I got respect for your mom and your dad, man, you know, and, you know, I wouldn't do that, man, you know, this, that, the other. I was like, yeah, okay, well, just don't do that. But, you know, time went on. You know, I was home maybe about a couple weeks later. You know, they went out to a Nita Baker's concert, and I was just being nosy, and I went into my sister's room and went into her drawers, and lo and behold, I found, you know, a sack of 50s. So I took it, and then I went around to the corner store with it, and just thinking about what the hell I'm gonna do with it. And I was pissed off, you know, naturally, because I done told this dude not to bring this stuff around here. So you know, guys coming in, they asking me about, you know, man, is Demetrius here? And then, you know, I'm like, man, I done told y'all about asking me, but you know, I done got into a fight, you know, about that before with some of them guys. So I just broke down and just said, well, you know, since they wanted it, you know, I had it in my pocket. You know, I didn't know the trouble that I could really get into having it at the time, because I didn't know the severity of having crack cocaine at that time. So I just started selling it. You know, I started selling 50, 50, 50, 50, and then next thing you know, it was all gone. Mm-hmm. And then so when I got home, I'm sitting on the porch waiting. Well, when they got home, I'm sitting on the porch. After they left the concert, I'm sitting on the porch, and he's shaking his head like, oh, you know, it's getting ready to be some trouble. So she eased on into the house. They went up on the side of the house. My sister eased on into the house and went into the room and went looking for it. And it wasn't there. So she came back out and asked me, did I go in her room and take something? And I was like, take what? And she's like, well, whatever it is, I want it back. And I was like, no, tell him to come ask me for it. So he came around there like, you know, man, you know, hey, man, I don't want no trouble. You know what I'm saying? He said, man, just give me my stuff. I'm going to go about my business. And I said, man, what did I tell you, man? So, and he was like, man, you're right, man. I'm gone, man. You ain't got to worry about me coming over here no more. So what I did was I told him I didn't have it. You know, I don't have it. So he's sitting there looking at me, and I'm looking at him. And then he's like, man, come on, man, just let me go about my business. I said, man, I ain't got it. So we stood there looking at each other for about another 5 minutes, and then I just pulled out the money. It's like, is this what you? I was like, I said, I don't have the product, but I got the money. So he started smiling and laughing, and he's like, man, you want a job? I was like, hell yeah. He's like, is it that easy? He's like, yeah. I was like, man. And ever since then, me and dude been rolling.
Crazy. And yeah. During that, how would you say you were around that time? You say this was at 85?
Yeah, I was 20.
Okay, 20. And you, and how old was Big Meech around this time?
About 17.
Okay.
You know, so, my sister, yeah, 17.
So how did it play out after that? Did you end up meeting Southwest T after that, or how did things play out after that once he offered the job? What happened was,
see, T and them, they were limited. Meech was limited. T wouldn't come over there because, you know, it was other guys that was in the neighborhood that didn't like Meech and them because they were hustlers. You know, they were getting their hustle on. And Meech knew a lot of people. People always were drawn to Meech. So they didn't like Meech, but they wouldn't mess with Meech because of my sister and my family. So as long as he was down there on 19th Street, he was okay. But he couldn't go no further than 19th Street back down in the E course. So once I got on with them, then it opened up, and then we started dealing with the factions around there. They got to really know what kind of guy Meech was, and that's how it all just took off. We just exploded on the scene down there.
Right. So let me ask you this. At that particular time, did they already have a name for the quote-unquote crew? Was it BMF, or what was the original name, or was there even a name at that time?
There wasn't no name at the time, but then we came up with one, and we came up, it was Rushtown.
From that moment, did things get out of control for you as far as being a quote-unquote, you know, college student going to school for criminal stuff like that? Like, once you seen that side of life, how did it impact you? Did it just automatically blow up and y'all start doing things out of state, or like, how was that progression?
Well, it was a progression after that. It was a guy down there locally that I went to high school with. He was about 3 or 4 years older than me. So we started basically working for him. You know, we started working for him. He would give us sacks. He would start stacking us up. We'd get like $7,800 worth of, or $8,000 worth of 50, which was like half a ball. And then we'd turn around and have to bring something back like $5,500. We'd keep $2,000, something like that. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So that's how we worked that, each one of us.
Okay. Now, you know, this may be kind of bouncing around a little bit, but I do want to ask an overall question, you know, not just at the beginning, just in general, for the people that know what BMF is, like now how they look at it, or during the height, or whatever the case may be, ultimately, what was your initial, like, what would you consider, like, your role it for BMF, like while it was actually working like a well-oiled machine?
What was my role, you know, as far as what? You talking about when it was present, like with Black Mafia Family?
Yes, with BMF, like what would you consider your role? Like what were you actually, you know, what was you doing during, you know, while everything was functioning?
I was in logistics. I was in charge of logistics. That means that I moved everything, the money and the yayo. That's what I did. I moved the product and the money, everything. That's what I do.
Okay. So at some point in time, you did end up getting locked up. Like, how long did you get locked up for?
I got 60 months. But before I got 60 months, I was in and out of jail. They sent me out on psych evaluations and all this. They were trying to scare me into taking the plea because they didn't have a case on me. So altogether, that and, you know, being locked up in Fort Huron and the Oklahoma Transfer Center and just my and as well as the halfway house with my probation, I did about 12 years.
Mm. When did the crew decide to move to ATL and why?
We moved about 89. We went down there on a visit, and then 90, we started moving around. And about 91, 92, we were in and out of Atlanta. We didn't really get down there to Atlanta really until about 97, 96, 97.
96, 97.
We were like a lot of our time was spent in St. Louis, Missouri.
Okay. Now going back to you being locked up for that, you know, the time that you end up being locked up for, ultimately, how did you end up getting locked up? Did you get actually caught with something, or did someone snitch on you? How did that end up happening?
The guys that I grew up with and some of around the neighborhood, a lot of and most of them were T people. Most of them was Terry's people. They all told them.
And that kind of lead me to the next question I was going to ask you. You know, can you explain the difference between what 263 and BMF, you know?
263, if you look at your phone and you see 263, it is spelled BMF out. So
right.
Instead of it being BMF, they had to change it to 263. The story behind that was one day out in California, Terry and his crew was out at Suge Knight's studio. And they were out hollering BMF. We had already knew Suge Knight, and Suge Knight knew us. So Suge Knight called in and was like, yo, called Meech, and was like, yo, man, I got this guy over here, man. Oh, he keeps saying he BMF, man, over here high side. And he's like, man, you know, he's like, man, what you want us to do with these dudes? And then Meech was like, well, you know, describe the guy to me, man. He's a big guy. He said, yeah, big one-eyed dude, man, with a bunch of jewelry on. He said, man, that's my brother, man. He said, man, put him on the phone. So he put, you know, should put T on, put Meech on the phone. And, put T on the phone. And Meech told him, look, man, y'all can't be using that name no more. So y'all gonna have to do something else, man. You know what I'm saying? And bam. So that's when they came 263. That's, you know, that was it. Because they had fell out in Gardena. Right. You know, it fell out in Gardena one night.
And that was going to be my next question. You know, what caused the split, you know, between, you know, so what ended up happening with that?
It was a commercial back in the day that Mary J. Blige did a Coca-Cola commercial. She was in a Bentley Azure, a silver Bentley Azure. I don't know if y'all remember that, but she did this commercial, and Meech had just bought the car. He had just bought the Azure. And T got furious when he found out about it, because T wouldn't come to California. T was staying in Detroit. So he got furious when he found out about it. He flew out there and was pissed at Meech and pissed at Pops, Wayne Wayne. He was Wayne Joyner. He was pissed at him because he felt as though they was doing something behind his back. But, you know, he was like, this should have been me. And you shouldn't have did this. And I'm the one that's supposed to did this. And that should have been my car in the commercial. And, you know, one thing about the brothers that all the way to the end that lasted was sibling rivalry. It was a strong competition thing between them. Not more so Meech, but T just had to outdo his brother at all times, and that ultimately brought the family down.
That's crazy. That's crazy. Now,
and that's the truth.
Now, you know, out of all the DVDs and different things I've seen, you know, being from Detroit, different things I've heard, people, you know, everybody always tried to bring up this guy named Doc Marshall that was, allegedly or supposed to be an accountant. You know, a lot of people focused on him. You know, what was his role in BMF, you know, and as far as, you know, in the DVDs people talked about, you know, he snitched and brought things down, you know, like, can you, what happened with Doc Marshall? Like, how did y'all meet him? How did he get into it? You know, what was his role? How did he end up snitching? And can you explain that from your perspective from the inside?
Doc Marshall got caught up on a murder in Florida from some drugs that one of his partners had got from T. When he got caught up on the murder down there, he was already in trouble. Not just him, but his girl, his baby's moms and all them, and his brothers and all them, Hassan Sherrod, all them, they were into fraud, credit card fraud, and they were into all types of what you would call that, trade line frauds and all that. They were doing all that type of stuff. So when he got caught up down there, they asked him where he got the drugs from. He mentioned Terry's name, and they had already had an open investigation in Atlanta against Terry and them anyway, against you know, the family. So what he did was they used him. They switched him over. I got the paperwork to prove it. They switched him over, and bam, they sent him on up there to go get with Terry and them, and he started getting houses and cars and started getting drugs from Terry and them, and that's how he infiltrated over there. Now, when he came over there with us, he tried to sell. We bought a few cars and stuff from him. He may have done something. He didn't do anything with me in particular, but you know the paperwork gonna say that they did though. But he never done anything with me. But they just put it all together. They was running out of time. The government was running out of time. They was running out of funding, so they had to put a story together, and they used Doc Marshall to put the story together, you know what I'm saying? But they had already had a story previously before that. It already started back in 2000. But they used Doc because he was closer. He was like the inside man, you know what I'm saying? He like the infiltrator. They used him as their, that was their ground. That was their ground zero. Right.
So, at some point in time, like, people, you know, kind of consider him, like, I guess you could use the terminology, like, smoke and mirrors. You know, can you explain that as far as with Doc Marshall? Like, what would you mean? What would that mean?
Well, they used him, like I said, we just said earlier, they used it as if he was running, you know, keeping the books and all that. They used him, they used him as an accountant. They used him as if he was managing both families' books, but he wasn't. That was just something they did so they can establish a RICO, you know what I'm saying, an ongoing continuous enterprise. So that was the reason why they used that. But in actuality, he was not the initial person that got the investigation started. He was not.
So who was the actual individual or the actual circumstance or situation that got the investigation started?
Harold Henry Mills and his wife, Tonisa Wells, got this whole investigation started. They got it all started from phone calls or doing on the phone, her talking back to this guy in jail and him being mad, you know. And it's all in the documents. I have some posted now on Instagram that you can go in there and look on _ the Real Black Mafia Family. You can go in there and you can look at it and you can see he's going to tell it. I ain't got to tell you. This is not my story. He's going to tell it. And the grand jury is going to also ask him those pertinent questions. That's going to show you. And look at the year now, because the year is going to be November 6th of 2002. That was 3 years and 1 month prior to them coming in the door. He was already talking about us. Where was he getting that information from? His son couldn't only been up about a year and a half years old. So he wasn't talking to his son.
Right.
He was talking with Tony Sewell.
And would you say when he was speaking to someone in jail, he was talking to Miss Welch, she was the one that was incarcerated?
No, he was incarcerated.
Oh,
she was with Terry.
Right, right.
So Terry was basically sleeping with the enemy the whole.
Did calling Sand sleeping with the enemy, did anyone else at that particular time within BMF have any inklings or anything about her, like in a negative way, that maybe she was a bad seed or anything like that? Or she just kind of was up under the rug, you know, in the clear? People didn't know that she, like, was messing things up.
Honestly, me and Demetrius knew how that relationship started. We never felt comfortable with that. Neither did Demetrius' mother or his sister nor his father. So we already knew what that was. But Meech, to be truthful, Meech never liked that girl. Never liked her. And it really fell out the day after he left Cancun, when we got off the plane. And we were getting ready to head back down to Atlanta. And Terry was like, well, he was not ready to leave yet. I mean, he was heading back down to Texas. And Terry was like, he's not ready to leave yet. You know, he wants to walk. He wants to walk Tony to Texas. He wants to walk Tony to the airport the next day. And he's like, man, she a grown-ass woman. She was standing right there. He said, man, she can walk herself there. Man, you just left. You've been with her all weekend. He said, man, we got to get back down there. And Terry went out and said, blurted out, like, man, you just trying to get back down there with them bitches and spend, you know, back down there with them bras and spend all your money on them bras. And Meech girl was standing right there, which is a no-no. Mm. So that really tore a lot of other stuff up. So, you know, so when you look at I blew a bag, you know what I'm saying? You look and you see her testimony. Everything she said in her testimony was basically false, because I the dates and everything, because if you go in there and you look at the IG page, the Instagram page, it's all right there. Harold is telling you everything. Her husband is telling you this, not me. Don't take Sauce's word for it. It's her.
Right.
It's him. He's telling it.
Now on one of these, one of the paperworks that I was looking at, there's a total, it's a big list of names. I'm trying to find it right here, where it's like, you know, at the beginning of, you know, the United States versus, and yes, then it says, yes, your name, and then it has a list of those names.
Yes.
It says witnesses. Like, what was going, yes, on, what was transpiring and going on during that time, and who are those individuals, and what was the parts they were playing?
They were people that got caught up, and it's called a catch and release. They had caught these people, and then they throw them back out there. They'll hold them for 3-4 minutes, question them, take pictures of everything, log everything, and, you know, take, you know, just make sure they got a full account of what they were, or what they had basically stopped the seizure, and then they take and throw them back out there. So those people were already compromised, and they were turned, and they were working for the government, and the people that got caught never told their employers or, you know, the family that they got caught. So they that was it. So it was like the catch and release program. It's like filling streams.
Right, right.
You know, you catch it, you snap it, you weigh it, you see how long it is, and you throw it back. They're looking for the big fish. So you don't take the little fish, you just, you know, you throw it back and hope to catch the big one. And that's what they done. Yeah. And those people that was on that list, it was like 39 of them. But all the names that were on that list were also government agents too. So those were people that they were testifying against. Those were people that, the people that got caught and released, they testified to these people also in front of a grand jury, which I have all that paperwork also, all those documents too.
Okay. Now, something very important that I wanted to ask you. When you got arrested and went to court, you ended up representing yourself. You didn't use an attorney at all?
No. They tried to give me one, but I didn't. I use them as standby counsel only. I don't need them to present me, because they don't know my case firsthand.
Right.
So what could you say to defend me? And I'm kind of familiar with the law anyway, so there's nothing you can say. And furthermore, you didn't have a case on me anyway. You know, you don't have a case. You only have some people that was compromised, which will say anything. So I kind of gave him, and then the judge, the prosecutor, she wasn't speaking, but the judge was, which constitutes a conflict of interest, because he's practicing law across the bench. So,
right.
You know,
And you were locked up when you were representing yourself. You were locked up for what at that particular moment?
Well, I was free at the time when I was representing myself. But me and the judge got into it, and I said something to him, and that's what really put the clamps on me. So they locked me up, and they floated me around for about a year. You know, I was on Common Air. I was at the Oklahoma Transfer Station. They sent me up to Seattle, Washington for the C-Tech up in Seattle, Washington for a psych evaluation for 8 months. You know, they was just, and then they sent me over to Port Huron down there. We're in the lockup down in Port Huron where Meech was locked up at, you know, in Port Huron. They sent me down there for like 6 months. So I had to tell them to just prosecute me, bring me back in. So the only way they was going to let me come back in was with an attorney. So once I got the attorney and I got in there, I made him stand by counsel again, and they had to give me all the paperwork.
And that's ultimately how you end up getting all the paperwork and surveillance videos and everything else.
Exactly, because I had it. He told her, the judge, Avon Cone, told the prosecutor, Don Isom, AUSA, to give me all the paperwork, everything. So she gave it to me, but she didn't give it to me in the order as, you know, she didn't give it to me in the discovery in the order that would have been afforded to a real attorney.
Right.
So I had to go in and find all this, and along the way, I'm seeing other things.
What would you consider like the most shocking thing that you ended up running across during that time once you got the paperwork and surveillance videos?
The most shocking part of it was when I seen in the seizure documents where Tonisa Welch was named in the RICO as under Title 21, Title 21 subsection 848 under the continuous criminal enterprise, she was named with Demetrius and Terry Flannery and Tonisa Welch, each individually charged with that with Title 2 under Title 21.
For the people that's listening to this that may not understand what Title 21 is, can you break that down like in layman terms so people can understand, and also explain exactly who Tonisha Welch is?
Title 21, subsection 848 is continuous criminal enterprise. That means that you are named in running a continuous criminal enterprise as kingpins. That means you are the bosses. That means you are the top. It means that you are the first three or the however many that's named in there under that particular offense, that you are looking at no less than 25 years automatically.
So with T and Meech, they were considered the kingpins, and they was considering her a queenpin, basically.
Exactly. She was named individually, and that's in the paperwork on IG page. It's right there. I put it, but I don't know why people don't see that.
Right. Now, I seen maybe 3 weeks ago, she ended up leaving a comment up under your Instagram page. And once again, what's your Instagram page name again?
It's _ the Real Black Mafia Family.
Okay. I seen her end up leaving a comment, and she said, you know, and this is what she put, so quote unquote, y'all need to quit this nonsense. Side who was who. When I met them in 88, they didn't have money. Cracking a corner don't count as a kingpin. You might not like T, but let's keep it 100. If it wasn't for him, wouldn't no one have money out there? You can talk about separation in 2003. Y'all need to stop disrespecting. You don't have to like him, but you don't have to downplay the man. I seen it. I know how the money came. What was that comment about, and what is she talking about?
Well, what she's saying basically is it's a slight to me, because she know that's my page. But she is trying to say that y'all listening to what drivers say in a few docs, which is documents.
Mm-hmm.
So what she's trying to do is slight me on a slide, and then she's like calling me a driver, which I was. But you know, as things grow, you just like you on a street corner, you sling crack. Eventually, you don't just move straight into the weight. You move from the small to the big. That's what most hustlers have done. So that's all that she's saying is true. But it changes the moving from moving rocks to moving keys, and from driving to logistics. So that's true. And then as far as the dots is concerned, a few dots, I do have a few dots. I got about 40,000 pages of documents. That's how I caught her. And she knows it. And what she's trying to do is downplay this, because she know what I'm about to do. She know what I'm about to expose.